All right, welcome to Mercy Hill. We're so glad that you are here. I'm Pastor Loudon, and this is the second week of a very quick two-part series. We're covered last week, the first part of James. So if you have your Bible, go ahead and if you would, open up to James chapter 1. We started in really verse 2, and we went through about verse 8, and I want to recap that moderately quick so that we can then jump into verse 9. But real quick, so recap, if you were here last week, you remember that we did the thing that all great preachers do. We started to do math problems. So if you missed last week, you're good. You're fine. It was a good week to miss. We were doing math, and it got weird real quick. But let's just kind of remember. Verse 2 of James chapter 1. Count it all joy, my brothers, when you encounter trials of any and many kinds, for you know that it produces steadfastness. So he has this idea that you take the joy that God gives you, apply it to the difficulties of life, and then it creates in you steadfastness. It's great. It's a good math problem. We like it. It's simple. And then he talks about another problem where if steadfastness completes its work, right, if it continues in your life to mold you and shape you, it then creates in you someone who is whole and complete, lacking in nothing. All right. So the joy of the Lord, so joy applied to difficulties equals steadfastness or toughness or completeness or wisdom. And if you continue in steadfastness in the way, in the journey of wisdom, then you become whole and wise. So he gives us a path. And then he talks about how if you lack any of this wisdom, if you lack any of these things, that you should then ask God, who gives generously, but don't do it doubting. Right? We shouldn't doubt. If you doubt, you then undermine the very mechanism by which we become whole and complete people. Right? That's how the thing works. It was not a disingenuous invitation. Right? That's what we talked about last week. So that's the idea. God, when you encounter trials and difficulties, he no longer, like the idea, the fear, the warning, is that we would then think, ooh, maybe he's not in control. James is telling us very clearly, no, God is absolutely in control. And then he kind of gives us, there's two implications that we have to draw from the text that kind of lead us to an application. One is we really don't have space or time to be complainers. Right? We can't be complainers. Why? Well, because we're supposed to be joying in all things, right? All difficulties. From the hardest of hard to the lightest of trials, we are to joy in them, seeing and knowing that God is both good and in control. The other thing is that we are called then to live our lives for real, in faith, to actually believe that God is in the little moments, right? That's what we talked about last week. That's at least I hope that's what you think we talked about last week. All right, so when we doubt, we do. We start to undermine and kind of rob God from doing that work in our lives. Now it leads us in to our actual text for today, and we're going to be starting in verse 9, so let's read together. Let the lowly brother boast in his exaltation and the rich in his humiliation, because like a flower of the grass he will pass away. For the sun rises with its scorching heat and withers the grass. Its flower falls and its beauty perishes. So also will the rich man fade away in the midst of his pursuits. Blessed is the man who remains steadfast under trial, for when he has stood the test, he will receive the crown of life, which God has promised to those who love him. Let no one say when he is tempted, I am being tempted by God, for God cannot be tempted with evil, and he himself tempts no one. But each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desires. Then desire, when it has conceived, gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is full grown, brings forth death. Do not be deceived, my beloved brothers. Every good gift and every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow due to change. Of his own will, he brought us forth by the word of truth, so that we should be a kind of first fruits of his creatures. All right, so there's a lot here. We're going to try and cover as much as we can. We did not get that task accomplished in the first service. You guys look like you're quick listeners, so let's do this. So James immediately starts to call out two people who are inside of a culture, and he's going to both warn them but charge them. That's one of the things I really love about James, is that he tells you what to do first, and then we'll ground it later. Count it all joy. Yeah. Why? Oh, okay, I guess you need to know why. Because it creates steadfastness. Right? You already knew that. So here, he then gives us a charge. But he talks to not everybody at once. He talks to everybody in two categories. So he says to the poor, you boast in your exaltation. And then to the rich, he says, you're to boast as well, but it's in your humiliation. All right, we count it all joy because God is in control. Hard times do not mean that God has left us or doesn't love us. And now he's taking that same concept, right? Because James is a singular letter. That's one of the things that you need to remember, is that this book is one singular letter to be read all at once. So some of the thoughts and ideas from verse 2 all the way through 8, they're going to be carried into 9 all the way through 18 and really the rest of the text, okay? So that's one of the things I want you to kind of keep in your mind, that we're going to be carrying some of those ideas and moving with them as we go throughout. So he says to the poor, boast in your exaltation, and to the rich, boast in your humiliation. The question I want to ask before we really even dive into what he's saying is, are we also in danger like James's readers are in danger? Okay. Are we immune to what he's talking about? Because like in their culture, right, they had a pretty clear distinction. Poor people are poor people, rich people are rich people. We kind of do this thing where we really don't know what we are a lot of times. Are we also in danger if we don't heed James's words? I would say that I think that it is very much that we need to. First, what does he say to the poor? He tells them to boast in the exaltation. What exaltation? He doesn't say the cross a lot. I think that's why a lot of people maybe have trouble with James. I mentioned Martin Luther last week and how Martin Luther called the book of James a right straw epistle, which I'm just sorry, like I don't have the confidence to throw shade at the Bible, but hey, there you go. But I get it. I get why he would think that, because he doesn't talk about the cross explicitly. But if we assume correctly that the exaltation that James is talking about is in the work of God through the cross, I think we're good. I think that's a good place to start. So he tells them, hey, poor person, don't hang your head. If you have the cross, do not hang your head. I think that we're probably in just as much danger as James's hearers, if not more so. Know how I know? Because I think many of us in this room, many of us are not millionaires. We might actually have some, and that's fine. We're going to get to you in a little bit. But many of us are not millionaires. And if we're pressed, we're probably a little embarrassed that we're not. We're a little embarrassed that we don't have more money than we do. Right? And like, just to actually drive the point home, I actually got some people's tithes reports, and we're going to put those on the screen. But if somebody were to pull up your bank account and put it on the screen, some of us would be like, oh, well, I mean, like, oh, well, see, let me tell you how, see, I have a checking and a savings. And see, that number is, we would immediately feel this guilt and this shame for not being more well off. Where do we get that? Where do we pick that up? And it's not only that it's just embarrassing, it's also that it feels like there's almost a moral weight to it. Like, it's not even okay to be poor in the United States. Right? We feel that. And James here is telling his reader, boast in your exaltation. This is something. This is something very interesting, very special. Now he goes to the rich brother and he says to them, you know, if you have a lot of money, okay, we're going to talk to you as well. But like us in this room, maybe the account's looking good. Maybe vacations at Bora Bora this year, not Gatlinburg, right? Yeah. Maybe we're going out to eat. Are we going to McDonald's? No, we're going to Chili's. Put on the good pants, all right? Right? We feel this, right? We feel this pull to kind of have our head a little higher and our chest a little up when things are going well, when the world is right. And that is, and money does do that to us. It does this thing where it makes us feel good, right? Imagine if you were to have, and this is kind of an audacious situation, but if you were to walk in to like a realtor's office and you're like, that's my dream house, I want it, and then a duffel bag of cash, smack it on the table, boom, give me the receipt, I'm out, I don't need a bank. That would feel, you would feel good about that, right? That would be a neat thing to feel. Or even more audacious, okay? I know that a duffel bag of cash is silly. Let's be even weirder, right? You pull up in your car, you get out, you take the nozzle, and then there's this little thing. You put it in your car, and then you pull it, and then you like put this little flap that keeps the nozzle open, and you don't even look at it. You just look off into the sunset thinking about whatever you want, and you're not paying attention to those numbers that are just rolling and rolling. It's even more audacious, I know. But that would feel good. It does. It sings this kind of siren song to us that we would love to have more than enough. We do. We want that. In every fiber of our being, we get that. We understand it. So maybe James has something here for us. Because in a lot of ways, we feel like the poor and we feel like the rich. Maybe we're in more danger than we thought. So I came to Mercy Hill about a year ago, a little less than a year ago. But the job that I came from, it was a great job. And I loved it. God gave me favor and I made it to the ranks to where I got to sit in the highest office of a big company. And I remember when I got that kind of that final promotion, there was this really, really strong desire to like call my mom, and who worked like, you know, my dad left when I was like 6 or 7 and he wasn't a huge part of the picture, but she worked like 3 and 4 jobs the entire time I was growing up just to provide for us. And it was amazing to watch her hard work. When I got that final promotion, I wanted to be like, check out my pay stub. Like, I made it. I did it. We get fancy dinners now, and I got an expense account, and like there are private planes involved, and like it was like amazing. And I wanted to be like, Mom, I made it. Look, I did it. I felt that in every fiber of my being. I felt that. I wanted money to validate my existence. I wanted to show my mom how much security I now had because of how much money I made. Huh. I seem to remember Jesus saying something about how you really can't have two gods. You're going to serve one or the other. And if I was looking for validation of existence, security, comfort, joy, I got to wonder what my God was. I got to wonder what our God is. Because that God that Jesus, if you're a guest with us, we usually, we normally go through an entire book. We don't just go through like a small chapter like we're doing today. And we've been going through Luke, and we go so slow, and it is wonderful. But we've been in the last couple of really months where Jesus has been talking about money, and it's like it's lesson after lesson. And it's like, no, we get it. And he's like, no, you don't. Here's another lesson. Banquet feast? Cool. Nope, another lesson. Manager? Okay, and another. And he keeps coming at us about money. And I got to keep wondering, like, why does he keep doing that? Oh, because it has an ability to get to our hearts in a way that really almost no other thing can. Even like sex and food, which are like really high on the temptation kind of thing, money does something to us that it's just different. And that's how James starts. So he's been talking about you applying the joy of the Lord to the difficulties and obstacles of life and it producing steadfastness so that then you would become whole and complete, lacking in nothing, mature in your faith. And then he immediately starts talking about money. Maybe that's another part of the difficulties that we're going to experience. You know, but we want to be rich. In our heart of hearts, sometimes we kind of realize that that's what we want. What is the warning that James is giving? He says to us, whether you be poor or whether you be rich, stop defining yourself by what you have or don't have. So like my temptation when I read this is to do this thing, because like here's the thing, there's a clarity, right? Poor and rich. The poor people in James's day knew they were poor and the rich knew they were rich. And he was able to address them as such. And they were like, yeah, I'm a rich guy. I'm a poor guy. But we're in this weird kind of space for most of us, right? Many of us feel like, oh, okay, well, I'm middle class. What do I do with this, right? And actually, not only am I middle class, I'm upper middle class, right? Again, we're going to Chili's, not Rafferty's or whatever it may be, right? We even have distinctions there. The temptation would be then to like take, okay, I'll take a portion of what he's saying to the poor person about boasting in his exaltation, and then I take a little portion of... Stop. No, that's not what... No. James is literally telling you, no matter where you are, poor or rich, do not define yourself by what you have. And that's the thing to easy... It's a very easy thing to say, but it is so hard to actually have faith in God to the point that you really and truly believe that he is enough. Imagine the audacity of someone actually poor, not just in our kind of functional definition these days, but in James's day, a person who doesn't know where their next meal is coming from. If we actually got to know that person in our culture, we would almost feel a desire to look down on them. And James says, pick your head up, poor person. You have nothing to be ashamed of. In fact, think about the audacity. If you're actually talking to that person and they're singing a song and they have joy coming out of every pore of their being because they are so excited about the goodness of God in their life, the world wouldn't get that. The world wouldn't understand that kind of joy. It would confound reason. They would have a hope that seems to be beyond understanding. And James gets this. So we draw from the charge and we take from what it is that we're supposed to do from James. And you kind of, if you kind of want to peg yourself on that spectrum, you'll say, okay, well, maybe I'm poor, maybe I'm rich. I don't think that's really the point for us to find out which one we are. Because even if we do find out where we are, we would then just find a way to look down or belittle the other. Now, I will say this that I think is pretty interesting is we see him give 8 words to the poor. Tells them to boast in their exaltation, but then he gives 4 lines to the rich. He doesn't do that because he's mad at the rich. He does it because they're in more danger. They are in far more danger than the poor are, of losing the path, of not actually believing in the cross, of not trusting in God and his wisdom. They're in more danger. I'm a big fan of C.S. Lewis, as every pastor that's ever existed since he was, you know, writing kind of is. And one of my favorite books by him is The Screwtape Letters. And The Screwtape Letters, if you've never read it, it's about a senior demon who is teaching his younger demon, Wormwood, his nephew, how to be a good demon and how to corrupt people. It's a fantastic ride of a book. It is wild. I absolutely recommend that you read it. But the idea is that Wormwood is teaching, or Screwtape is teaching, how to actually corrupt the world. And I would say one of the things that if I were on the enemy side that I would try to do is I would try to take an entire generation of people and I would try to convince them that they're not the class of people that are in more danger so that when they encounter the things that they're actually supposed to be looking out for, they won't think that they need to watch out for them because they're not the group that's in danger. The rich here are more in danger. And I think that would be a pretty slick move of the enemy if he were to convince you that you're not. I don't know a lot of things, but I do know that in the past 150 years, over the entire spectrum of human existence, we have never had an easier opportunity to access food, clean water, clothes, and shelter. And yet we still walk away thinking we're not rich or in the same dangers that James is talking about. Real quick aside, I'm just going to do a quick little thing. There's a lot of assumption that I'm saying here about kind of where we're all at economically. Some of us live in paycheck to paycheck, some of you not. But the assumption here is that most of us are not looking, we're not looking for where our next meal is coming from. But I do want to say, like, just as James said, if that is you, we've got about 41 small group leaders, many of them in this room, and they represent a whole host of people that are either actively loving and serving and helping people, have recently done so, or they are at least, at the very least, willing and looking for opportunities to love and care. If you are in the family of God with us, we want to put our arm around you. Do not hold your head down because you're in that spot. Don't be ashamed. If we look down on you, that is a condemnation on us. Let us love you. Also, join a small group. Quick plug. But the good news that James knows is the thing that equalizes that to where we don't look down on anyone. And we don't look up to anyone because of what they have. Because more often than not, Jesus is not, he's not lamenting the poor person for their haughty attitude. The good news is that we have been saved from that. And this is the thing where, like, the cross saves us from a lot of stuff, right? Sin and death, hell, we get heaven, right? It saves us from a lot of stuff. But let me ask it in a different way. Has the cross saved you in a way that it actually allows you to be poor? Has the cross saved you to have exactly what you have now and be exactly where you are now? Or has our culture gripped your heart so much that you believe the thing that it's just not yet enough? A little more, a little further, and then you'll have it. It would be great to be able to pay off a house in the swipe of a pen, but I gotta believe that it would be far more valuable to actually trust in God, even in the midst of our difficulties and in what we lack. Has the cross saved you to be exactly where you are right now? Can you trust that even though you didn't get the promotion, or you didn't get the this, or you don't have the boat or the house or the car, even though all of that, it's not there and it's out of your grasp, do you have everything that you need for life and godliness? Because 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 3, it tells us that if we have the cross, we have everything that we need, both for life and for godliness. And James gets that. Has he saved you from being rich or poor? Either one. Maybe we need to be saved from how we view ourselves in finance. Now, there's a whole lot more verses here, so let's do it. Going on to verse 12, join me. Blessed is the man who remains steadfast under trial, for when he has stood the test, he will receive the crown of life which God has promised to those who love him. Let no one say when he is tempted, I'm being tempted by God, for God cannot be tempted with evil, and he himself tempts no one. But each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desires. Then desire, when it has conceived birth, gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is full grown, brings forth death. All right, James has been talking and operating from this place of God's control and his diligent care of all things, right? And now he revisits in verse 12 the same concept that he had in verse 2, 3, and 4, right? Count it all joy, because it produces steadfastness, and then that brings whole and completeness, right? A good, beautiful picture of life full. Now he says, he's saying the same thing. Those who persevere, those who continue in the faith, those who have counted joy all the difficulties, and they've persevered, they now get something. He's talking in a much bigger sense, in a grander sense. He says they get the crown of life, which is a poetic way for James to say the fullest of salvation, the end salvation, the end result. There's a part of us, there's a part of me that still wants to look at this transactionally. I give God faith, he gives me wisdom, we part ways, and now I'm wise. I'm like Judge Judy out there, just like, false. Bull, right? No, it's a relational concept. And I know that because of the end of verse 12. What does it say right there at the very end of verse 12? Right? He says, God, it's which God has promised to those who love him. So James is talking to people who have been in the, he's talking to the Jews, to the Jewish people who have been dispersed amongst the world, and he knows them. Jesus, also talking to the same crowd, again, I'll reference Martin Luther, we'll use him. He was talking to people who were within the Catholic Church and were well-founded, but all of them, all of these teachers seem to be saying, hey, you think you're okay, but maybe you're not. And I think even today, we are now sitting, we're in the South, right? We're in the Bible Belt, we're in the heart of it, and there, everybody's a Christian, right? Everybody's a Christian. We're good. We're from the South. Like, do you see bumper stickers on my car? I'm good. But there's this thing where maybe they're not. And I want to point out that James gets this. Because the way that you undermine an entire religion, the way that you subvert an entire group of people to thinking that they're okay when they're not okay, I think it's this. It's you turn God and church into a transaction, not a relationship. That's your first, like that's the first and biggest step to really subverting the whole thing. I get baptized, now I go to heaven. I give my 10%, now I can spend everything else guilt-free. If I volunteer at church, I'm gonna have wings on my mansion. It's gonna be wild up there. If we reduce the church and the scriptures and this to anything other than an actual relationship with God, that we walk with him, we know him, we hear him, we see him, that we actually like him to the point that we spend time with him. The first step you gotta do to subvert that whole thing is make it about a transaction and not about a relationship. Now, there are transactional parts. We see that very clearly. And everything that James has taught up to this point has been to inspire and been based on this idea that God is in control. Difficulties in life come, he's still in control. In fact, he's got a purpose for them. It's going to produce in you steadfastness. But if you keep reading and thinking about God's control of all things, it won't take you long to end up in a place where you have some questions. So it's the natural logical progression, I would say. If you're a quick Bible turner, let's go to the book of Habakkuk. I'm going to read for you. You don't have to turn there if you're not super speeding. Starting in verse 1, chapter 1. The oracle that Habakkuk the prophet saw. O Lord, how long shall I cry for help, and you will not hear? I cry to you violence, and you will not save. Why do you make me see iniquity, and why do you idly look at wrong? Destruction and violence are before me. Strife and contention arise. So the law is paralyzed, and justice never goes forth. For the wicked surround the righteous, so justice goes forth perverted. God, how are you good and in control if all of these things that I'm seeing are happening? How? Now, I've been a pastor here for about 11 months, and almost every single conversation that I've had with somebody about their struggles with faith, they usually come from or sound like the same thing. And you don't have to have been a pastor to know this. You probably already know where I'm going, but it is the idea that this thing happened to me or to someone I love. It occurred, and in that, I now don't understand how God can be both good and in control if that thing happened. We're Habakkuk. It is so hard, because that's the difficulty of life, and that is what James is driving at. God, how can you be good and in control, like James is saying, if this thing happened? Verse 13, let no one say when he is tempted, I am being tempted by God. For God cannot be tempted with evil, and he himself tempts no one. I would bet strongly that many of you in this room also struggle with your faith, and it is for the same reason that you saw or felt or experienced something, and you just can't reckon it with the idea that God is still good and in control. That is why you see in verse 16, James says, do not be deceived, my beloved brothers. Every good and perfect gift came from God. So I have a question. How can God distance himself from evil and then claim all the glory when things are good? Seems awfully convenient. It's one of the hardest questions in the Bible. It's one of the hardest questions of faith, period. And it's why James started his book the way he did. It's why Jesus taught the way he did. It's why Paul spent so much time in Romans saying the things that he said. I don't want to profess to know how God works with all of evil and creation. And I'm not even going to pretend that I have that figured out. But I can tell you on Friday, there was a small group. They went out to the beach, and my wife and I got an invitation, so we went out and hung out with them, and it was a great time. So I'm out there. We're out on the beach. Look over to the right. All the guys are fishing. We had like 7 rods in the water. It was pandemonium. Lines getting crossed. People getting hooked. It was wonderful. But I look over, and all the men are there, and then I look slightly to the back, and there are all our wives talking and laughing, probably just really enjoying how great we are and talking about how wonderful their husbands are, how we haven't gained weight, and we kind of know everything, and we get it right, and we never argue. I look over to my left, and my 9-year-old is in the waves with his little boogie board and his friends, and they're getting thrown and just laughing. And then I look back, and then my 6-year-old, they're playing tag with all the other kids his age. And then I look back, and there in front of the ladies is my 2-year-old, and he's taking sand and like shoveling into a bucket and then dumping it out and then doing it over. That moment was a gift from God, and I know it. Because he made this world for us to enjoy it and to love one another and to be in that moment knowing that he is good and that is what we were made for. He was good to me in that moment. It was good to me in the moments after, the moments leading up to it. But then if you watch my two-year-old, who's an absolute chaos monster, he's sitting there and, you know, this didn't happen, but like, for instance, as he's sitting there, if he decided, I would like the truck that kid is playing with, again, he's two, he goes, I already have a shovel. And then Cain slew Abel. It wasn't God's fault that selfishness then entered the picture. And that's what James is trying to tell us. Like, when evil is in the picture, don't let it tempt you to think that God is not loving or in control. And where is evil more manifest, more known to us than the sin that's inside of us? So then he goes into a thing where he talks about how does sin work? And it is vivid, right? This is pretty wild. So let no one say that he is tempted. I'm being tempted by God. For God doesn't tempt with evil, and he himself tempts no one. But each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desire. Then desire, when it has conceived, gives birth to sin. And sin, when it is full grown, gives birth to death. James is saying a couple of things all at once. So before we talk about that, I want to say three things of what I think James is saying. One, he's very clearly saying evil does not come from God. Good comes from God, and he's in control of all of it. What? Evil doesn't come from God. Good comes from God, and yet God is still in control of all of it. So then he talks about where does this evil come from? How does it come about? Each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desire. That's how sin works. And this is kind of wild. When you think about this actual illustration of what he's saying here, it's kind of vivid and a little graphic. So sin is when we embrace an errant desire, a desire that really shouldn't be there, something that we want either more than God or as much as God or to replace God or to give us something that really God is only the only one who can give us, right? That's what we do. We take a desire and then we run with it. And then we mentally impregnate it. James, you said consummate. Did you? Let me look. Okay. Same thing. Got it. Yeah. Same word. Yep. Same word. Each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desire. Seduced is the other way you can look at that, this is graphic. And the desire, when it has conceived, gives birth. I think we need to get some new church bumper stickers made. The evil that you and I have felt at the hands of others is because they had a desire that they had and they mentally embraced and consummated that relationship with, and that commitment then birthed sin, and then that sin grew up and they let it grow up in their house, and instead of killing that sin, it became full grown and then killed them. That's how sin works in our lives. You have something that replaces God, and he's just coming off of talking about money. Either that's a really neat coincidence or James is saying something about how we view ourselves in light of our finances. Maybe he's trying to set us free because the cross has set us free from that. And then maybe the evil that we see in the world that tempts us to think that God is both not good or in control, maybe he's trying to give us an understanding. Now we know from Habakkuk, we know from David in the Psalms, that there are a lot of times where we see God not doing what we know is good. Like, why is this continuing to happen? Why are these people allowed to be abused? Why are these people allowed to abuse others? God, where is your justice? And then we get to us. You and I in this room right now, in this very moment, the struggles we have with faith are often because of the sins that others have done to us, the hurts that we've had. I know that I've talked to not a few people who you might be in church for the first time in a while, or there was a period where someone hurt you and you just couldn't even come to church because that hurt was so bad, right? I know. James knows. I'm not going to pretend to know how all this stuff works. Like, how is God in control and evil doesn't come from him? I'm not. Because even if I were to know, if I were to give you the greatest exposition, if I wrote a really great essay and a position paper on God and evil and how they work and don't work, I know a couple of things. James says that God is in control of everything. He's good. But when you see evil, that wasn't from him. I don't know how that works. I don't know how he's in fully control. I don't know how his asymmetrical relationship between good and evil, I don't know how that exactly works. But I know that James held on to the idea that evil doesn't come from God. God is good and God is in control. But the thing that I know that's more important than all that, because when you and I actually feel evil, when we actually experience it, whenever the terrors of life pierce the theoretical and actually happen to you in your person, whether you be the one that's being victimized or you're the one who is doing it to others, a good position paper is never going to be enough. But I do know that Jesus was a man of sorrow. I know that he saw death and what it did to his friend Lazarus and what it did to all the people that were around him, and that he wept. He saw the sting of death and he wept. He also saw it with every time that he was cursed at on the day that he would die. Every punch, every thorn, every nail that was driven into his body, and yet he said nothing. He bore it. He endured it. And I legitimately have trouble with the idea of, if I am the Father watching my perfect Son, who is unequaled in majesty and glory, and he is being abused by the wickedness of the hands of the thing that I created, I wipe out that creation. Like, you all have seen dogs. You've seen some that maybe nip or bite. I love dogs. Love cats, love animals. But have one of them nip at my child. It's Old Yeller time. We're shutting that down quick. It's not even close. So if I'm the Father and I'm watching my Son be abused and beaten and then hung on a cross, I rip heaven open, I say stop, and I crush everything that's in my way. He doesn't. How does God let that evil persist in that moment? I don't know. I don't know. But he does rip the veil in the Holy of Holies, in the temple. He was less concerned with his Son and more concerned with the fact that we get to now be in the presence of him. Because of all the evil that you and I have both experienced and done to others and the hurts that we've done, in Christ, we get to stand in his presence, because all the torture that he bore, we now take on ourselves. So, poor brother, boast in your exaltation. Boast in it. Because even though you don't have money, it doesn't matter. You have the cross of Christ and get to walk and know God. And those of you who are rich, boast in your humiliation that you have been tempted, or maybe even think that what you have is of worth of anything in the grand scope of all of this. Final part here, verse 16. Do not be deceived, my brothers, for every good and perfect gift comes from above and from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow due to change. Of his own will, he brought us forth by the word of truth, that we should be a kind of first fruits of his creatures. This is brilliant. This is one of those moments when, if you're reading and you go really slow, you start to kind of realize, oh my goodness, Bible study is just amazing. And I hope that, like, as we read this, that you would be encouraged to read the Bible more, because, like, if an idiot like that can do it, right? So keep reading, but this is brilliant. I never saw this. I've read James a bunch of times. I never saw it. It wasn't until we slowed down with that one-on-one discipleship program. Every good gift comes from above. Don't be deceived into thinking that God is not loving or good because there is evil in the world. Don't be deceived. That is the deception that James is telling you. And then he grounds it with this cosmological argument that every good, perfect gift comes from who? The Father of lights. When he says lights, he's talking about heavenly beings, heavenly bodies. He's talking about stars, moon, planets, sun. And then he says, God, who creates those things that have changing and variation and adjustments and they eclipses and the stars move and all of this stuff that happens with this creation that he created, there is no change or variation in him. So James is saying to us that God has created this thing and is still in many ways not like it. So in the same way, you and I should have the confidence, even though we may not understand how evil in our lives, evil in ourselves, the temptations that we have that still seem to keep winning and we can't overcome them, and we keep being like, God, why do I keep doing this stupid thing? Why can't I stop? Even in that, that we place our trust in his goodness and his glory and not blame him, because even though it's a part of his created world, he's not like that. So the call is not to trust a system. The call is not to trust a system where you then just count joy for all the difficulties. Not just an exchange, like verse 12 says, to take your perseverance and then turn that into a crown of glory. He's calling us to trust his heart, to trust his plan. Evil does not come from him. He is in control of all things, and he is good. It is really hard to justify, to rectify, and reckon that evil does exist in this world and his goodness, no doubt about it. But James is not unaware of that difficulty. So for you and I in this room, for the rest of our lives, I pray that we would continue to show up trusting in the goodness of God, hoping in what he's doing. And it is insane. If you read the rest of Habakkuk, God answers Habakkuk, but he doesn't answer him like, oh, it's okay, child. He's actually like, no, it gets worse. The bloodthirsty Chaldeans are coming. You have no idea what I'm doing, but I'm doing something that is good, even though I'm allowing evil to persist a little longer. But here's the hope, is that there is coming a day when he's going to wipe away every tear and every wrong will be righted. Why? Because he said he would, and because he's good. But we live here and now, where we have to have faith, we have to trust him, we have to put our hope in him, we have to put our arms around one another, we have to encourage one another, we've got to fight with all that we have out of thankfulness, because he's already won the victory for us. Let's pray. Father, we thank you so much for your love for us, for your care for us. Help us to never confuse the fact that evil persists in this world as you not loving us or being in control. Forgive us for where we have. And I pray for any person in this room who doesn't know you in a way that they are confident of your love. I pray that they would give their life to Jesus. I pray that they would lay themselves at the foot of the cross and trust completely, because we can't save ourselves. The evils that others have done to us and the evils that we have done to others, there is no way that we can fix that problem. Only you can, Father. And we beg you, give us hearts that see these truths. Let us walk in these tensions. Let us not accuse you of evil, but fully trust that you are both in control and that you love us, because all things work together for the good of those who love him. And we want that. It's in your son's name we pray. Amen.